society. They apply so happily to the late case that Sir Leicester has come from the library to my lady's room expressly to read them aloud.
"The man who wrote this article," he observes by way of preface,
nodding at the fire as if he were nodding down at the man from a mount,
"has a well-balanced mind."
The man's mind is not so well-balanced, but that he bores my lady, who, after a languid effort to listen, or rather a languid resignation of herself to a show of listening, becomes distraught, and falls into a contemplation of the fire, as if it were her fire at Chesney Wold, and she had never left it. Sir Leicester, quite unconscious, reads on through his double eyeglass, occasionally stopping to remove his glass, and express approval as,
"Very true indeed. Very properly put. I have frequently made the same remark myself,"
invariably losing his place after each observation, and going up and down the column to find it again. Sir Leicester is reading with infinite gravity and state when the door opens, and the mercury in powder makes this strange announcement.
"The young man, my lady, of the name of Guppy."
Sir Leicester pauses, stares, repeats in a killing voice,
"The young man of the name of Guppy?"
Looking round, he beholds the young man of the name of Guppy, much discomfited, and not presenting a very impressive letter of introduction in his manner and appearance.
"Pray," says Sir Leicester to Mercury, "what do you mean by announcing with this abruptness a young man of the name of Guppy?"
"I beg your pardon, Sir Leicester, but my lady said she would see the young man whenever he called. I was not aware that you were here, Sir Leicester."
With this apology, Mercury directs a scornful and indignant look at the young man of the name of Guppy, which plainly says, "What do you come calling here for, and getting me into a row?" "It's quite right. I gave him those directions," says my lady. "Let the young man wait."
"By no means, my lady. Since he has your orders to come, I will not interrupt you."
Sir Leicester, in his gallantry, retires, rather declining to accept a bow from the young man as he goes out, and majestically supposing him to be some shoemaker of intrusive appearance. Lady Dedlock looks imperiously at her visitor when the servant has left the room, casting her eyes over him from head to foot. She suffers him to stand by the door and asks him what he wants.
"That your ladyship would have the kindness to oblige me with a little conversation," returns Mr. Guppy, embarrassed. "You are, of course, the person who has written me so many letters."
"Several, your ladyship. Several before your ladyship condescended to favour me with an answer."
"And could you not take the same means of rendering a conversation unnecessary? Can you not still?"
Mr. Guppy screws his mouth into a silent "no," and shakes his head.
"You have been strangely importunate. If it should appear, after all, that what you have to say does not concern me, and I don't know how it can, and don't expect that it will, you will allow me to cut you short with but little ceremony. Say what you have to say, if you please."
My lady, with a careless toss of her screen, turns herself towards the fire again, sitting almost with her back to the young man of the name of Guppy.
"With your ladyship's permission, then," says the young man, "I will now enter on my business. Ahem. I am, as I told your ladyship in my first letter, in the law. Being in the law, I have learnt the habit of not committing myself in writing, and therefore I did not mention to your ladyship the name of the firm with which I am connected, and in which my standing, and I may add income, is tolerably good. I may now state to your ladyship, in confidence, that the name of that firm is Kenge and Carboy, of Lincoln's Inn, which may not be altogether unknown to your ladyship in connection with the case in Chancery of Jarndyce and Jarndyce."
My lady's figure begins to be expressive of some attention. She has ceased to toss the screen and holds it as if she were listening.
"Now, I may say to your ladyship at once," says Mr. Guppy, a little emboldened, "it is no matter arising out of Jarndyce and Jarndyce that made me so desirous to speak to your ladyship, which conduct I have no doubt did appear, and does appear, obtrusive, in fact almost blackguardly."
After waiting for a moment to receive some assurance to the contrary, and not receiving any, Mr. Guppy proceeds.
"If it had been Jarndyce and Jarndyce, I should have gone at once to your ladyship's solicitor, Mr. Tulkinghorn, of the Fields. I have the pleasure of being acquainted with Mr. Tulkinghorn. At least we move when we meet one another. And if it had been any business of that sort, I should have gone to him.
My lady turns a little round and says, "You had better sit down." "Thank your ladyship." Mr. Guppy does so. "Now, your ladyship." Mr. Guppy refers to a little slip of paper on which he has made small notes of his line of argument, and which seems to involve him in the densest obscurity whenever he looks at it. I place myself entirely in your ladyship's hands. If your ladyship was to make any complaint to Kenge and Carboy, or to Mr. Tulkinghorn, of the present visit, I shall be placed in a very disagreeable situation. That I openly admit. Consequently, I rely upon your ladyship's honour. My lady, with a disdainful gesture of the hand that holds the screen, assures him of his being worth no complaint from her. "Thank your ladyship," says Mr. Guppy. "Quite satisfactory. Now, Dash it, the fact is that I put down a head or two here on the order of the points I thought of touching upon, and they're written short, and I can't quite make out what they mean. If your ladyship will excuse me taking it to the window half a moment, Mr. Guppy, going to the window, tumbles into a pair of lovebirds, to whom he says in his confusion, "I beg your pardon, I am sure." This does not tend to the greater legibility of his notes. He murmurs, growing warm and red, and holding the slip of paper now close to his eyes, now a long way off. "C.S. What's C.S. for? Oh, E.S. Oh, I know. Yes, to be sure." And comes back enlightened. "I am not aware," says Mr. Guppy, standing midway between my lady and his chair, "whether your ladyship ever happened to hear of, or to see, a young lady of the name of Miss Esther Summerson." My lady's eyes look at him full. "I saw a young lady of that name not long ago, this past autumn." "Now, did it strike your ladyship that she was like anybody?" asks Mr. Guppy, crossing his arms, holding his head on one side and scratching the corner of his mouth with his memoranda. My lady removes her eyes from him no more.
"No." "Not like your ladyship's family?"
"No."
"I think your ladyship," says Mr. Guppy, "can hardly remember Miss Summerson's face." "I remember the young lady very well. What has this to do with me?"
"Your ladyship, I do assure you that having Miss Summerson's image imprinted on my art, which I mention in confidence, I found, when I had the honour of going over your ladyship's mansion of Chesney Wold while on a short out in the county of Lincolnshire with a friend, such a resemblance between Miss Esther Summerson and your ladyship's own portrait that it completely knocked me over, so much so that I didn't at the moment even know what it was that knocked me over. And now I have the honour of beholding your ladyship near. I have often since that taken the liberty of looking at your ladyship in your carriage in the park, when I dare say you was not aware of me, but I never saw your ladyship so near. It's really more surprising than I thought it."
Young man of the name of Guppy, there have been times when ladies lived in strongholds and had unscrupulous attendants within call, when that poor life of yours would not have been worth a minute's purchase with those beautiful eyes looking at you as they look at this moment. My lady, slowly using her little hand screen as a fan, asks him again what he supposes that his taste for likenesses has to do with her.
"Your ladyship," replies Mr. Guppy, again referring to his paper, "I am coming to that. Dash these notes. Oh, Mrs. Chadband, yes."
Mr. Guppy draws his chair a little forward and seats himself again. My lady reclines in her chair composedly, though with a trifle less of graceful ease than usual, perhaps, and never falters in her steady gaze. Stop a minute, though. Mr. Guppy refers again. E.S. twice. Oh, yes. Yes, I see my way now, right on. Rolling up the slip of paper as an instrument to point his speech with, Mr. Guppy proceeds.
"Your ladyship, there is a mystery about Miss Esther Summerson's birth and bringing up. I am informed of that fact because, which I mention in confidence, I know it in the way of my profession at Kenge and Carboy's. Now, as I have already mentioned to your ladyship, Miss Summerson's image is imprinted on my art. If I could clear this mystery for her, or prove her to be well related, or find that having the honour to be a remote branch of your ladyship's family, she had a right to be made a party in Jarndyce and Jarndyce, why, I might make a sort of a claim upon Miss Summerson to look with an eye of more dedicated favour on my proposals than she has exactly done as yet. In fact, as yet she hasn't favoured them at all."
A kind of angry smile just dawns upon my lady's face.
Now, it's a very singular circumstance, your ladyship, says Mr. Guppy, though one of those circumstances that do fall in the way of us professional men, which I may call myself, for though not admitted, yet I have had a present of my articles made to me by Kench and Carboy, on my mother's advancing from the principal of her little income the money for the stamp, which comes heavy, that I have encountered the person who lived as servant with the lady who brought Miss Summerson up before Mr. Jarndyce took charge of her. That lady was a Miss Barbary, your ladyship. Is the dead colour on my lady's face, reflected from the screen which has a green silk ground, and which she holds in her raised hand as if she had forgotten it, or is it a dreadful paleness that has fallen on her? Did your ladyship, says Mr. Guppy, ever happen to hear of Miss Barbary? I don't know. I think so, yes. Was Miss Barbary at all connected with your ladyship's family? My lady's lips move, but they utter nothing. She shakes her head. Not connected? Says Mr. Guppy. Oh, not to your ladyship's knowledge, perhaps. Ah, but might be. Yes. After each of these interrogatories, she has inclined her head. Very good. Now, this Miss Barbary was extremely close, seems to have been extraordinarily close for a female, females being generally, in common life at least, rather given to conversation, and my witness never had an idea whether she possessed a single relative. On one occasion, and only one, she seems to have been confidential to my witness on a single point, and she then told her that the little girl's real name was not Esther Summerson, but Esther Hawden. My God! Mr. Guppy stares. Lady Dedlock sits before him, looking him through, with the same dark shade upon her face, in the same attitude even to the holding of the screen, with her lips a little apart, her brow a little contracted, but for the moment dead. He sees her consciousness return, sees a tremor pass across her frame like a ripple over water, sees her lips shake, sees her compose them by a great effort, sees her force herself back to the knowledge of his presence and of what he has said. All this so quickly that her exclamation and her dead condition seem to have passed away like the features of those long-preserved dead bodies sometimes opened up in tombs, which, struck by the air like lightning, vanish in a breath. Your ladyship is acquainted with the name of Hawden? I have heard it before. Name of any collateral or remote branch of your ladyship's family? No. Now, your ladyship, says Mr. Guppy, I come to the last point of the case, so far as I have got it up. It's going on, and I shall gather it up closer and closer as it goes on. Your ladyship must know, if your ladyship don't happen by any chance to know already, that there was found dead at the house of a person named Crook, near Chancery Lane some time ago, a law writer, in great distress, upon which law-writer there was an inquest, and which law-writer was an anonymous character, his name being unknown. But, your ladyship, I have discovered very lately that that law-writer's name was Hawden. And what is that to me? Aye, your ladyship, that's the question. Now, your ladyship, a queer thing happened after that man's death. A lady started up, a disguised lady, your ladyship, who went to look at the scene of action, and went to look at his grave. She hired a crossing-sweeping boy to show it her. If your ladyship would wish to have the boy produced in corroboration of this statement, I can lay my hand upon him at any time. The wretched boy is nothing to my lady, and she does not wish to have him produced. Oh, I assure your ladyship it's a very queer start indeed, says Mr. Guppy. If you was to hear him tell about the rings that sparkled on her fingers when she took her glove off, you'd think it quite romantic. There are diamonds glittering on the hand that holds the screen. My lady trifles with the screen and makes them glitter more, again with that expression which in other times might have been so dangerous to the young man of the name of Guppy. It was supposed, your ladyship, that he left no rag or scrap behind him by which he could be possibly identified, but he did. He left a bundle of old letters. The screen still goes, as before. All this time her eyes never once release him. They were taken and secreted. And tomorrow night, your ladyship, they will come into my possession. Still, I ask you, what is this to me? Your ladyship, I conclude with that. Mr. Guppy rises. If you think there's enough in this chain of circumstances put together, in the undoubted strong likeness of this young lady to your ladyship, which is a positive fact for a jury, in her having been brought up by Miss Barbary, in Miss Barbary stating Miss Summerson's real name to be Hawdon, in your ladyship's knowing both these names very well, and in Hawdon's dying as he did, to give your ladyship a family interest in going further into the case, I will bring these papers here. I don't know what they are, except that they are old letters. I've never had them in my possession yet. I will bring those papers here as soon as I get them, and go over them for the first time with your ladyship. I have told your ladyship my object. I have told your ladyship that I should be placed in a very disagreeable situation if any complaint was made, and all is in strict confidence. Is this the full purpose of the young man of the name of Guppy, or has he any other? Do his words disclose the length, breadth, depth of his object and suspicion in coming here, or if not, what do they hide? Here's a match for my lady there. She may look at him, but he can look at the table and keep that witness-box face of his from telling anything. You may bring the letters, says my lady, if you choose. Your ladyship is not very encouraging, upon my word and honour, says Mr. Guppy, a little injured. You may bring the letters, she repeats in the same tone, if you please. It shall be done. I wish your ladyship good day. On a table near her is a rich bauble of a casket, barred and clasped, like an old strong chest. She, looking at him still, takes it to her and unlocks it. Oh, I assure your ladyship, I am not actuated by any motives of that sort, says Mr. Guppy, and I couldn't accept anything of the kind. I wish your ladyship good day, and am much obliged to you all the same. So the young man makes his bow and goes downstairs, where the supercilious Mercury does not consider himself called upon to leave his Olympus by the hall fire to let the young man out. As Sir Leicester basks in his library and dozes over his newspaper, is there no influence in the house to startle him? Not to say to make the very trees at Chesney Wold fling up their knotted arms, the very portraits frown, the very armour stir. No. Words, sobs, and cries are but air, and air is so shut in and shut out throughout the house in town that sounds need be uttered trumpet-tongued indeed by my lady in her chamber to carry any faint vibration to Sir Leicester's ears, and yet this cry is in the house, going upward from a wild figure on its knees.
Oh, my child! My child! Not dead in the first hours of her life, as my cruel sister told me, but sternly nurtured by her after she had renounced me and my name. Oh, my child! Oh, my child!
Chapter 30. Esther's Narrative. Richard had been gone away some time when a visitor came to pass a few days with us. It was an elderly lady. It was Mrs. Woodcourt, who, having come from Wales to stay with Mrs. Bayham Badger, and having written to my guardian, by her son Alan's desire, to report that she had heard from him and that he was well, and sent his kind remembrances to all of us, had been invited by my guardian to make a visit to Bleak House. She stayed with us nearly 3 weeks. She took very kindly to me, and was extremely confidential, so much so that sometimes she almost made me uncomfortable. I had no right, I knew very well, to be uncomfortable because she confided in me, and I felt it was unreasonable. Still, with all I could do, I could not quite help it. She was such a sharp little lady, and used to sit with her hands folded in each other, looking so very watchful while she talked to me, that perhaps I found that rather irksome. Or perhaps it was her being so upright and trim, though I don't think it was that, because I thought that quaintly pleasant. Nor can it have been the general expression of her face, which was very sparkling and pretty for an old lady. I don't know what it was. Or at least if I do now, I thought I did not then. Or at least... but it don't matter. Of a night when I was going upstairs to bed, she would invite me into her room, where she sat before the fire in a great chair. And, dear me, she would tell me about Morgan ap Cerrig until I was quite low-spirited. Sometimes she recited a few verses from Crumlin Wallinwer and the Mulin Willinwot, if those are the right names, which I dare say they are not, and would become quite fiery with the sentiments they expressed. though I never knew what they were, being in Welsh, further than that they were highly eulogistic of the lineage of Morgan ap Kerrig. "So, Miss Summerson," she would say to me with stately triumph, "this, you see, is the fortune inherited by my son. Wherever my son goes, he can claim kindred with ap Kerrig. He may not have money, but he always has what is much better. Family, my dear." I had my doubts of their caring so very much for Morgan ap Kerrig in India and China, but of course I never expressed them. I used to say it was a great thing to be so highly connected. "It is, my dear, a great thing," Mrs. Woodcourt would reply. "It has its disadvantages. My son's choice of a wife, for instance, is limited by it. But the matrimonial choice of the royal family is limited in much the same manner." Then she would pat me on the arm and smooth my dress, as much as to assure me that she had a good opinion of me, the distance between us notwithstanding. "Poor Mr. Woodcourt, my dear," she would say, and always with some emotion, for with her lofty pedigree she had a very affectionate heart, "was descended from a great Highland family, the MacCourts of MacCourt. He served his king and country as an officer in the Royal Highlanders, and he died on the field. My son is one of the last representatives of two old families. With the blessing of heaven he will set them up again and unite them with another old family." It was in vain for me to try to change the subject, as I used to try, only for the sake of novelty, or perhaps because—but I need not be so particular. Mrs. Woodcourt never would let me change it. "My dear," she said one night, "you have so much sense, and you look at the world in a quiet manner so superior to your time of life, that it is a comfort to me to talk to you about these family matters of mine. You don't know much of my son, my dear, but you know enough of him, I dare say, to recollect him." "Yes, ma'am, I recollect him." "Yes, my dear. Now, my dear, I think you are a judge of character, and I should like to have your opinion of him." "Oh, Mrs. Woodcourt," said I, "that is so difficult." "Why is it so difficult, my dear?" she returned. "I don't see it myself." "To give an opinion?" "On so slight an acquaintance, my dear, that's true." I didn't mean that, because Mr. Woodcourt had been at our house a good deal altogether, and had become quite intimate with my guardian. I said so, and added that he seemed to be very clever in his profession, we thought, and that his kindness and gentleness to Miss Flight were above all praise. "You do him justice," said Mrs. Woodcourt, pressing my hand. "You define him exactly. Alan is a dear fellow, and in his profession faultless. I say it though I am his mother. Still, I must confess he is not without faults, love." "None of us are," said I. "Ah, but his really are faults that he might correct, and ought to correct," returned the sharp old lady, sharply shaking her head. "I am so much attached to you that I may confide in you, my dear, as a third party, wholly disinterested, that he is fickleness itself." I said I should have thought it hardly possible that he could have been otherwise than constant to his profession, and zealous in the pursuit of it, judging from the reputation he had earned. "You are right again, my dear," the old lady retorted, "but I don't refer to his profession, look you." "Oh," said I. "No," said she, "I refer, my dear, to his social conduct. He is always paying trivial attentions to young ladies, and always has been ever since he was 18. Now, my dear, he has never really cared for any one of them, and has never meant in doing this to do any harm, or to express anything but politeness and good nature. Still, it's not right, you know, is it?"
"No," said I, as she seemed to wait for me.
"And it might lead to mistaken notions, you see, my dear."
I supposed it might.
"Therefore, I have told him many times that he really should be more careful both in justice to himself and in justice to others. And he has always said, 'Mother, I will be, but you know me better than anybody else does, and you know I mean no harm, in short, mean nothing.' All of which is very true, my dear, but is no justification. However, as he is now gone so far away, and for an indefinite time, and as he will have good opportunities and introductions, we may consider this past and gone. And you, my dear," said the old lady, who was now all nods and smiles, "regarding your dear self, my love?"
"Me, Mrs. Woodcourt?"
"Not to be always selfish, talking of my son, who has gone to seek his fortune and to find a wife. When do you mean to seek your fortune and to find a husband, Miss Summerson? Hey, look you, now you blush."
I don't think I did blush. At all events, it was not important if I did, and I said my present fortune perfectly contented me, and I had no wish to change it.
"Shall I tell you what I always think of you, and the fortune yet to come for you, my love?" said Mrs. Woodcourt.
"If you believe you are a good prophet," said I.
"Why, then,
It is that you will marry someone very rich and very worthy, much older, 25 years perhaps, than yourself, and you will be an excellent wife and much beloved, and very happy. That is a good fortune, said I. But why is it to be mine? My dear, she returned, there's suitability in it. You are so busy and so neat, and so peculiarly situated altogether that there's suitability in it, and it will come to pass. And nobody, my love, will congratulate you more sincerely on such a marriage than I shall. It was curious that this should make me uncomfortable, but I think it did. I know it did. It made me for some part of that night uncomfortable. I was so ashamed of my folly that I did not like to confess it even to Ada, and that made me more uncomfortable still. I would have given anything not to have been so much in the bright old lady's confidence if I could have possibly declined it. It gave me the most inconsistent opinions of her. At one time I thought she was a storyteller, and at another time that she was the pink of truth. Now I suspected that she was very cunning. Next moment I believed her honest Welsh heart to be perfectly innocent and simple. And after all, what did it matter to me, and why did it matter to me? Why could not I, going up to bed with my basket of keys, stop to sit down by her fire and accommodate myself for a little while to her, at least as well as to anybody else, and not trouble myself about the harmless things she said to me? Impelled towards her, as I certainly was, for I was very anxious that she should like me, and was very glad indeed that she did, why should I harp afterwards, with actual distress and pain, on every word she said, and weigh it over and over again in 20 scales? Why was it so worrying to me to have her in our house, and confidential to me every night, when I yet felt that it was better and safer, somehow, that she should be there than anywhere else? These were perplexities and contradictions that I could not account for, at least, if I could. But I shall come to all that by and by, and it is mere idleness to go on about it now. So when Mrs. Woodcourt went away, I was sorry to lose her, but was relieved, too. And then Caddy Jellyby came down, and Caddy brought such a packet of domestic news that it gave us abundant occupation. First Caddy declared, and would at first declare nothing else, that I was the best adviser that ever was known. This, my pet said, was no news at all, and this, I said, of course, was nonsense. Then Caddy told us that she was going to be married in a month, and that if Ada and I would be her bridesmaids, she was the happiest girl in the world. To be sure, this was news indeed, and I thought we never should have done talking about it. We had so much to say to Caddy, and Caddy had so much to say to us. It seemed that Caddy's unfortunate papa had got over his bankruptcy. Gone through the Gazette, was the expression Caddy used, as if it were a tunnel, with a general clemency and commiseration of his creditors, and had got rid of his affairs in some blessed manner without succeeding in understanding them, and had given up everything he possessed, which was not worth much, I should think, to judge from the state of the furniture, and had satisfied everyone concerned that he could do no more, poor man. So he had been honourably dismissed to the office to begin the world again. What he did at the office I never knew. Caddy said he was a custom house and general agent, and the only thing I ever understood about that business was that when he wanted money more than usual, he went to the docks to look for it, and hardly ever found it. As soon as her papa had tranquillised his mind by becoming this shorn lamb, and they had removed to a furnished lodging in Hatton Garden, where I found the children when I afterwards went there cutting the horsehair out of the seats of the chairs and choking themselves with it, Caddy had brought about a meeting between him and old Mr. Turveydrop, and poor Mr. Jellyby, being very humble and meek, had deferred to Mr. Turveydrop's deportment so submissively that they had become excellent friends. By degrees old Mr. Turveydrop, thus familiarised with the idea of his son's marriage, had worked up his parental feelings to the height of contemplating that event as being near at hand, and had given his gracious consent to the young couple commencing housekeeping at the Academy in Newman Street when they would. "And your papa, Caddy? What did he say?" "Oh, poor Pa," said Caddy, "only cried, and said he hoped we might get on better than he and Ma had got on. He didn't say so before Prince, he only said so to me. And he said, my poor girl, you've not been very well taught how to make a home for your husband, but unless you mean with all your heart to strive to do it, you had better murder him than marry him, if you really love him."
"And how did you reassure him, Caddy?"
"Why, it was very distressing, you know, to see poor Pa so low, and hear him say such terrible things. And I couldn't help crying myself, but I told him that I did mean it with all my heart,
and that I hoped our house would be a place for him to come and find some comfort in of an evening, and that I hoped and thought I could be a better daughter to him there than at home. Then I mentioned Peepy's coming to stay with me, and then Pa began to cry again, and said the children were Indians.
Indians, Caddy?
Yes, said Caddy, wild Indians. And Pa said, here she began to sob, poor girl, not at all like the happiest girl in the world, that he was sensible the best thing that could happen to them was their being all tomahawked together.
Ada suggested that it was comfortable to know that Mr. Jellyby did not mean these destructive sentiments.
No, of course I know Pa wouldn't like his family to be weltering in their blood, said Caddy, but he means that they are very unfortunate in being Ma's children, and that he is very unfortunate in being Ma's husband, and I'm sure that's true, though it seems unnatural to say so.
I asked Caddy if Mrs. Jellyby knew that her wedding day was fixed.
Oh, you know what Ma is, Esther, she returned. It's impossible to say whether she knows it or not. She has been told it often enough, and when she is told it, she only gives me a placid look, as if I was I don't know what, a steeple in the distance, said Caddy with a sudden idea. And then she shakes her head and says, oh, Caddy, Caddy, what a tease you are, and goes on with the Borrioboola letters.
And about your wardrobe, Caddy, said I, for she was under no restraint with us.
Well, my dear Esther, she returned, drying her eyes, I must do the best I can, and trust to my dear prince never to have an unkind remembrance of my coming so shabbily to him. If the question concerned an outfit for Borrioboola, Ma would know all about it, and would be quite excited. Being what it is, she neither knows nor cares.
Caddy was not at all deficient in natural affection for her mother, but mentioned this with tears as an undeniable fact, which I am afraid it was. We were sorry for the poor dear girl, and found so much to admire in the good disposition which had survived under such discouragement, that we both at once, I mean Ada and I, proposed a little scheme that made her perfectly joyful. This was her staying with us for 3 weeks, my staying with her for one, and our all three contriving and cutting out and repairing and sewing and saving, and doing the very best we could think of to make the most of her stock. My guardian being as pleased with the idea as Caddy was, we took her home next day to arrange the matter, and brought her out again in triumph, with her boxes, and all the purchases that could be squeezed out of a 10-pound note, which Mr. Jellyby had found in the docks, I suppose, but which he at all events gave her. What my guardian would not have given her if we had encouraged him, it would be difficult to say, but we thought it right to compound for no more than her wedding dress and bonnet. He agreed to this compromise, and if Caddy had ever been happy in her life, she was happy when we sat down to work. She was clumsy enough with her needle, poor girl, and pricked her fingers as much as she had been used to ink them. She could not help reddening a little now and then, partly with the smart and partly with vexation at being able to do no better, but she soon got over that and began to improve rapidly. So day after day she and my darling and my little maid Charlie and a milliner out of the town and I sat hard at work as pleasantly as possible. Over and above this, Caddy was very anxious to learn housekeeping, as she said. Now, mercy upon us, the idea of her learning housekeeping of a person of my vast experience was such a joke that I laughed and coloured up and fell into a comical confusion when she proposed it. However, I said, Caddy, I'm sure you are very welcome to learn anything that you can learn of me, my dear. And I showed her all my books and methods and all my fidgety ways. You would have supposed that I was showing her some wonderful inventions by her study of them. And if you had seen her, whenever I jingled my housekeeping keys, get up and attend me, certainly you might have thought that there never was a greater impostor than I, with a blinder follower than Caddy Jellyby. So what with working and housekeeping, and lessons to Charlie, and backgammon in the evening with my guardian, and duets with Ada, the 3 weeks slipped fast away. Then I went home with Caddy to see what could be done there, and Ada and Charlie remained behind to take care of my guardian. When I say I went home with Caddy, I mean to the furnished lodging in Hatton Garden. We went to Newman Street 2 or 3 times, where preparations were in progress, a good many, I observed, for enhancing the comforts of old Mr. Turveydrop, and a few for putting the newly married couple away cheaply at the top of the house. But our great point was to make the furnished lodging decent for the wedding breakfast, and to imbue Mrs. Jellyby beforehand with some faint sense of the occasion. The latter was the more difficult thing of the two, because Mrs. Jellyby and an unwholesome boy occupied the front sitting-room. The back one was a mere closet, and it was littered down with waste paper and Borrioboolan documents, as an untidy stable might be littered with straw. Mrs. Jellyby sat there all day, drinking strong coffee, dictating and holding Borrioboolan interviews by appointment. The unwholesome boy, who seemed to me to be going into a decline, took his meals out of the house. When Mr. Jellyby came home, he usually groaned and went down into the kitchen. There he got something to eat, if the servant would give him anything, and then, feeling that he was in the way, went out and walked about Hatton Garden in the wet. The poor children scrambled up and tumbled down the house, as they had always been accustomed to do. The production of these devoted little sacrifices, in any presentable condition, being quite out of the question at a week's notice, I proposed to Caddy that we should make them as happy as we could on her marriage morning in the attic where they all slept, and should confine our greatest efforts to her mamma, and her mamma's room, and a clean breakfast. In truth, Mrs. Jellyby required a good deal of attention, the latticework up her back having widened considerably since I first knew her, and her hair looking like the mane of a dustman's horse. Thinking that the display of Caddy's wardrobe would be the best means of approaching the subject, I invited Mrs. Jellyby to come and look at it, spread out on Caddy's bed in the evening after the unwholesome boy was gone. "My dear Miss Summerson," said she, rising from her desk with her usual sweetness of temper, "these are really ridiculous preparations, though your assisting them is a proof of your kindness. There is something so inexpressibly absurd to me in the idea of Caddy being married. Oh, Caddy, you silly, silly, silly puss." She came upstairs with us, notwithstanding, and looked at the clothes in her customary far-off manner. They suggested one distinct idea to her, for she said with her placid smile and shaking her head, "My good Miss Summerson, at half the cost this weak child might have been equipped for Africa." On our going downstairs again, Mrs. Jellyby asked me whether this troublesome business was really to take place next Wednesday, and on my replying yes, she said, "Will my room be required, my dear Miss Summerson, for it's quite impossible that I can put my papers away?" I took the liberty of saying that the room would certainly be wanted, and that I thought we must put the papers away somewhere. "Well, my dear Miss Summerson," said Mrs. Jellyby, "you know best, I dare say. But by obliging me to employ a boy, Caddy has embarrassed me to that extent, overwhelmed as I am with public business, that I don't know which way to turn. We have a ramification meeting, too, on Wednesday afternoon, and the inconvenience is very serious." "It is not likely to occur again," said I, smiling. "Caddy will be married but once, probably." "That's true," Mrs. Jellyby replied. "That's true, my dear. I suppose we must make the best of it." The next question was how Mrs. Jellyby should be dressed on the occasion. I thought it very curious to see her looking on serenely from her writing-table while Caddy and I discussed it, occasionally shaking her head at us with a half-reproachful smile, like a superior spirit who could just bear with our trifling. The state in which her dresses were, and the extraordinary confusion in which she kept them, added not a little to our difficulty. But at length we devised something not very unlike what a commonplace mother might wear on such an occasion. The abstracted manner in which Mrs. Jellyby would deliver herself up to having this attire tried on by the dressmaker, and the sweetness with which she would then observe to me how sorry she was that I had not turned my thoughts to Africa, were consistent with the rest of her behaviour. The lodging was rather confined as to space, but I fancied that if Mrs. Jellyby's household had been the only lodgers in St. Paul's or St. Peter's, the sole advantage they would have found in the size of the building would have been its affording a great deal of room to be dirty in. I believe that nothing belonging to the family which it had been possible to break was unbroken at the time of those preparations for Caddy's marriage, that nothing which it had been possible to spoil in any way was unspoilt, and that no domestic object which was capable of collecting dirt, from a dear child's knee to the door-plate, was without as much dirt as could well accumulate upon it. Poor Mr. Jellyby, who very seldom spoke, and almost always sat when he was at home with his head against the wall, became interested when he saw that Caddy and I were attempting to establish some order among all this waste and ruin, and took off his coat to help. But such wonderful things came tumbling out of the closets when they were opened: bits of mouldy pie, sour bottles, Mrs. Jellyby's caps, letters, tea, forks, odd boots and shoes of children, firewood, wafers, saucepan lids, damp sugar in odds and ends of paper bags, footstools, blacklead brushes, bread, Mrs. Jellyby's bonnets, books with butter sticking to the binding, gutted candle-ends put out by being turned upside down in broken candlesticks, nutshells, heads and tails of shrimps, dinner-mats, gloves, coffee-grounds, umbrellas, that he looked frightened, and left off again. But he came regularly every evening, and sat without his coat, with his head against the wall, as though he would have helped us, if he had known how.
"Poor Pa,"
said Caddy to me on the night before the great day, when we really had got things a little to rights.
"It seems unkind to leave him, Esther, but what could I do if I stayed? Since I first knew you, I have tidied and tidied over and over again. But it's useless. Ma and Africa together upset the whole house directly. We never have a servant who don't drink. Ma's ruinous to everything."
Mr. Jellyby could not hear what she said, but he seemed very low indeed, and shed tears, I thought.
"My heart aches for him, that it does," sobbed Caddy. "I can't help thinking tonight, Esther, how dearly I hope to be happy with Prince, and how dearly Pa hoped, I dare say, to be happy with Ma. What a disappointed life!"
"My dear Caddy," said Mr. Jellyby,
looking slowly round from the wall.
It was the first time, I think, I ever heard him say three words together. "Yes, Pa," cried Caddy, going to him and embracing him affectionately.
"My dear Caddy," said Mr. Jellyby, "never have—"
"Not Prince, Pa," faltered Caddy. "Not have Prince?"
"Yes, my dear," said Mr. Jellyby. "Have him, certainly. But never have—"
I mentioned in my account of our first visit in Tavy's Inn that Richard described Mr. Jellyby as frequently opening his mouth after dinner without saying anything. It was a habit of his. He opened his mouth now a great many times and shook his head in a melancholy manner.
"What do you wish me not to have? Don't have what, dear Pa?" asked Caddy, coaxing him with her arms around his neck.
"Never have a mission, my dear child."
Mr. Jellyby groaned and laid his head against the wall again, and this was the only time I ever heard him make any approach to expressing his sentiments on the Borrioboolan question. I suppose he had been more talkative and lively once, but he seemed to have been completely exhausted long before I knew him. I thought Mrs. Jellyby never would have left off serenely looking over her papers and drinking coffee that night. It was 12 o'clock before we could obtain possession of the room, and the clearance it required then was so discouraging that Caddy, who was almost tired out, sat down in the middle of the dust and cried. But she soon cheered up, and we did wonders with it before we went to bed. In the morning it looked, by the aid of a few flowers and a quantity of soap and water and a little arrangement, quite gay. The plain breakfast made a cheerful show, and Caddy was perfectly charming. But when my darling came, I thought, and I think now, that I never had seen such a dear face as my beautiful pet's. We made a little feast for the children upstairs, and we put Peepy at the head of the table, and we showed them Caddy in her bridal dress, and they clapped their hands and hurrahed, and Caddy cried to think that she was going away from them, and hugged them over and over again until we brought Prince up to fetch her away, when, I'm sorry to say, Peepy bit him. Then there was old Mr. Turveydrop downstairs, in a state of deportment not to be expressed, benignly blessing Caddy and giving my guardian to understand that his son's happiness was his own parental work, and that he sacrificed personal considerations to ensure it.
"My dear sir," said Mr. Turveydrop, "these young people will live with me. My house is large enough for their accommodation, and they shall not want the shelter of my roof. I could have wished—you will understand the allusion, Mr. Jarndyce, for you remember my illustrious patron, the Prince Regent—I could have wished that my son had married into a family where there was more deportment. But the will of heaven must be done."
Mr. and Mrs. Pardiggle were of the party. Mr. Pardiggle, an obstinate-looking man with a large waistcoat and stubbly hair, who was always talking in a loud bass voice about his might, or Mrs. Pardiggle's might, or their five boys' mites. Mr. Quail, with his hair brushed back as usual, and his knobs of temples shining very much, was also there, not in the character of a disappointed lover, but as the accepted of a young, at least an unmarried, lady, a Miss Whisk, who was also there. Miss Whisk's mission, my guardian said, was to show the world that woman's mission was man's mission, and that the only genuine mission of both man and woman was to be always moving declaratory resolutions about things in general at public meetings. The guests were few, but were, as one might expect at Mrs. Jellyby's, all devoted to public objects only. Besides those I have mentioned, there was an extremely dirty lady with her bonnet all awry, and the ticketed price of her dress still sticking on it, whose neglected home, Caddy told me,
was like a filthy wilderness, but whose church was like a fancy fair. A very contentious gentleman, who said it was his mission to be everybody's brother, but who appeared to be on terms of coolness with the whole of his large family, completed the party. A very contentious gentleman, who said it was his mission to be everybody's brother, but who appeared to be on terms of coolness with the whole of his large family, completed the party. A party, having less in common with such an occasion, could hardly have been got together by any ingenuity. Such a mean mission as the domestic mission was the very last thing to be endured among them. Indeed, Miss Whisk informed us with great indignation, before we sat down to breakfast, that the idea of woman's mission lying chiefly in the narrow sphere of home was an outrageous slander on the part of her tyrant man. One other singularity was that nobody with a mission, except Mr. Quayle, whose mission, as I think I have formerly said, was to be in ecstasies with everybody's mission, cared at all for anybody's mission, Mrs. Pardiggle being as clear that the only one infallible course was her course of pouncing upon the poor and applying benevolence to them like a strait waistcoat, as Miss Whisk was that the only practical thing for the world was the emancipation of woman from the thraldom of her tyrant man. Mrs. Jellyby, all the while, sat smiling at the limited vision that could see anything but Borrioboola Gha. But I am anticipating now the purport of our conversation on the ride home, instead of first marrying Caddy. We all went to church, and Mr. Jellyby gave her away. The air with which old Mr. Turveydrop, with his hat under his left arm, the inside presented at the clergyman like a cannon, and his eyes creasing themselves up into his wig, stood stiff and high-shouldered behind us bridesmaids during the ceremony, and afterwards saluted us, I could never say enough to do it justice. Miss Whisk, whom I cannot report as prepossessing in appearance, and whose manner was grim, listened to the proceedings as part of woman's wrongs, with a disdainful face. Mrs. Jellyby, with her calm smile and her bright eyes, looked the least concerned of all the company. We duly came back to breakfast, and Mrs. Jellyby sat at the head of the table, and Mr. Jellyby at the foot. Caddy had previously stolen upstairs to hug the children again, and tell them that her name was Turveydrop. But this piece of information, instead of being an agreeable surprise to Peepy, threw him on his back in such transports of kicking grief that I could do nothing on being sent for but accede to the proposal that he should be admitted to the breakfast table. So he came down and sat in my lap, and Mrs. Jellyby, after saying in reference to the state of his pinafore, "Oh, you naughty Peepy, what a shocking little pig you are," was not at all discomposed. He was very good, except that he brought down Noah with him, out of an ark I had given him before we went to church, and would dip him head first into the wine glasses and then put him in his mouth. My guardian, with his sweet temper and his quick perception and his amiable face, made something agreeable even out of the ungenial company. None of them seemed able to talk about anything but his or her own one subject, and none of them seemed able to talk about even that as part of a world in which there was anything else. But my guardian turned it all to the merry encouragement of Caddy and the honour of the occasion, and brought us through the breakfast nobly. What we should have done without him, I am afraid to think, for all the company despising the bride and bridegroom and old Mr. Turveydrop, and old Mr. Turveydrop, in virtue of his deportment, considering himself vastly superior to all the company, it was a very unpromising case. At last the time came when poor Caddy was to go, and when all her property was packed on the hired coach and pair that was to take her and her husband to Gravesend. It affected us to see Caddy clinging then to her deplorable home, and hanging on her mother's neck with the greatest tenderness.
"I'm very sorry I couldn't go on writing from dictation, Ma," sobbed Caddy. "I hope you forgive me now."
"Oh, Caddy, Caddy," said Mrs. Jellyby, "I've told you over and over again that I've engaged a boy, and there's an end of it."
"You are sure you're not the least angry with me, Ma? Say you are sure before I go away, Ma."
"You foolish Caddy," returned Mrs. Jellyby. "Do I look angry, or have I inclination to be angry, or time to be angry? How can you?"
"Take a little care of Pa while I'm gone, Mama."
Mrs. Jellyby positively laughed at the fancy.
"You romantic child," said she, lightly patting Caddy's back. "Go along. I'm excellent friends with you. Now good-bye, Caddy, and be very happy."
Then Caddy hung upon her father, and nursed his cheek against hers, as if he were some poor, dull child in pain. All this took place in the hall. Her father released her, took out his pocket-handkerchief, and sat down on the stairs with his head against the wall. I hope he found some consolation in walls. I almost think he did.
And then Prince took her arm in his and turned with great emotion and respect to his father, whose deportment at that moment was overwhelming.
"Thank you, over and over again, father," said Prince, kissing his hand. "I'm very grateful for all your kindness and consideration regarding our marriage, and so, I can assure you, is Caddy."
"Very," sobbed Caddy, "very."
"My dear son," said Mr. Turveydrop, "and dear daughter, I have done my duty. If the spirit of a sainted woman hovers above us and looks down on the occasion, that and your constant affection will be my recompense. You will not fail in your duty, my son and daughter, I believe."
"Dear father, never," cried Prince.
"Never, never, dear Mr. Turveydrop," said Caddy.
"This," returned Mr. Turveydrop, "is as it should be. My children, my home is yours, my heart is yours, my all is yours. I will never leave you. Nothing but death shall part us. My dear son, you contemplate an absence of a week, I think?"
"A week, dear father. We shall return home this day week."
"My dear child," said Mr. Turveydrop, "let me, even under the present exceptional circumstances, recommend strict punctuality. It is highly important to keep the connection together, and schools, if at all neglected, are apt to take offence. This day week, father, we shall be sure to be home to dinner."
"Good," said Mr. Turveydrop.
"You will find fires, my dear Caroline, in your own room, and dinner prepared in my apartment."
"Yes, yes, Prince," anticipating some self-denying objection on his son's part with a great air.
"You and our Caroline will be strange in the upper part of the premises, and will, therefore, dine that day in my apartment. Now, bless ye."
They drove away, and whether I wondered most at Mrs. Jellyby or at Mr. Turveydrop, I did not know. Ada and my guardian were in the same condition when we came to talk it over, but before we drove away too, I received a most unexpected and eloquent compliment from Mr. Jellyby. He came up to me in the hall, took both my hands, pressed them earnestly, and opened his mouth twice. I was so sure of his meaning that I said, quite flurried,
"You are very welcome, sir. Pray don't mention it."
"I hope this marriage is for the best, guardian," said I, when we three were on our road home.
"I hope it is, little woman. Patience. We shall see."
"Is the wind in the east today?" I ventured to ask him.
He laughed heartily and answered, "No."
"But it must have been this morning, I think," said I.
He answered, "No," again, and this time my dear girl confidently answered, "No," too, and shook the lovely head, which, with its blooming flowers against the golden hair, was like the very spring.
"Much you know of east winds, my ugly darling," said I, kissing her in my admiration. I couldn't help it.
Well, it was only their love for me, I know very well, and it is a long time ago. I must write it, even if I rub it out again, because it gives me so much pleasure. They said there could be no east wind where somebody was. They said that wherever Dame Durden went, there was sunshine and summer air.
Chapter 31. Nurse and Patient. I had not been at home again many days when one evening I went upstairs into my own room to take a peep over Charlie's shoulder and see how she was getting on with her copybook. Writing was a trying business to Charlie, who seemed to have no natural power over a pen, but in whose hand every pen appeared to become perversely animated, and to go wrong and crooked, and to stop and splash, and sidle into corners like a saddle donkey. It was very odd to see what old letters Charlie's young hand had made, they so wrinkled and shrivelled and tottering, it so plump and round. Yet Charlie was uncommonly expert at other things, and had as nimble little fingers as I ever watched.
"Well, Charlie,"
said I, looking over a copy of the letter O, in which it was represented as square, triangular, pear-shaped, and collapsed in all kinds of ways.
"We are improving. If we only get to make it round, we shall be perfect, Charlie."
Then I made one, and Charlie made one, and the pen wouldn't join Charlie's neatly, but twisted it up into a knot.
"Never mind, Charlie. We shall do it in time."
Charlie laid down her pen, the copy being finished, opened and shut her cramped little hand, looked gravely at the page, half in pride and half in doubt, and got up and dropped me a curtsy.
"Thank you, miss." "If you please, miss, did you know a poor person of the name of Jenny?"
"A brickmaker's wife, Charlie, yes."
"She came and spoke to me when I was out a little while ago, and said you knew her, miss."
She asked me if I wasn't the young lady's little maid, meaning you for the young lady, miss, and I said, yes, miss. I thought she had left this neighbourhood altogether, Charlie. So she had, miss, but she's come back again to where she used to live, she and Liz. Did you know another poor person of the name of Liz, miss? I think I do, Charlie, though not by name. That's what she said, returned Charlie. They have both come back, miss, and have been tramping high and low. Tramping high and low, have they, Charlie? Yes, miss. If Charlie could only have made the letters in her copy as round as the eyes with which she looked into my face, they would have been excellent. And this poor person came about the house 3 or 4 days, hoping to get a glimpse of you, miss, all she wanted, she said. But you were away. That was when she saw me. She saw me a-going about, miss, said Charlie, with a short laugh of the greatest delight and pride, and she thought I looked like your maid. Did she, though, really, Charlie? Yes, miss, said Charlie. Really and truly. And Charlie, with another short laugh of the purest glee, made her eyes very round again and looked as serious as became my maid. I was never tired of seeing Charlie in the full enjoyment of that great dignity, standing before me with her youthful face and figure, and her steady manner, and her childish exultation breaking through it now and then in the pleasantest way. "And where did you see her, Charlie?" said I. My little maid's countenance fell as she replied. "By the doctor's shop, miss." For Charlie wore her black frock yet. I asked if the brickmaker's wife were ill, but Charlie said no. It was someone else. Someone in her cottage who had tramped down to St. Albans and was tramping he didn't know where. A poor boy, Charlie said. No father, no mother, no anyone.
Like as Tom might have been, miss, if Emma and me had died after father, said Charlie, her round eyes filling with tears. And she was getting medicine for him, Charlie?
She said, miss, returned Charlie, how that he had once done as much for her. My little maid's face was so eager, and her quiet hands were folded so closely in one another as she stood looking at me, that I had no great difficulty in reading her thoughts.
"Well, Charlie," said I, "it appears to me that you and I can do no better than go round to Jenny's and see what's the matter."
The alacrity with which Charlie brought my bonnet and veil, and having dressed me, quaintly pinned herself into her warm shawl and made herself look like a little old woman, sufficiently expressed her readiness. So Charlie and I, without saying anything to anyone, went out. It was a cold, wild night, and the trees shuddered in the wind. The rain had been thick and heavy all day, and with little intermission for many days. None was falling just then, however. The sky had partly cleared, but was very gloomy, even above us, where a few stars were shining. In the north and northwest, where the sun had set 3 hours before, there was a pale, dead light, both beautiful and awful, and into it long sullen lines of clouds waved up like a sea stricken immovable as it was heaving. Towards London a lurid glare overhung the whole dark waste, and the contrast between these two lights and the fancy which the redder light engendered of an unearthly fire gleaming on all the unseen buildings of the city and on all the faces of its many thousands of wandering inhabitants was as solemn as might be. I had no thought that night, none, I am quite sure, of what was soon to happen to me. But I have always remembered since that when we had stopped at the garden gate to look up at the sky, and when we went upon our way, I had for a moment an undefinable impression of myself as being something different from what I then was. I know it was then and there that I had it. I have ever since connected the feeling with that spot and time, and with everything associated with that spot and time, to the distant voices in the town, the barking of a dog, and the sound of wheels coming down the miry hill. It was Saturday night, and most of the people belonging to the place where we were going were drinking elsewhere. We found it quieter than I had previously seen it, though quite as miserable. The kilns were burning, and a stifling vapour set towards us with a pale blue glare. We came to the cottage, where there was a feeble candle in the patched window. We tapped at the door and went in. The mother of the little child who had died was sitting in a chair on one side of the poor fire by the bed, and opposite to her a wretched boy, supported by the chimney-piece, was cowering on the floor. He held under his arm, like a little bundle, a fragment of a fur cap, and as he tried to warm himself he shook until the crazy door and window shook. The place was closer than before, and had an unhealthy and a very peculiar smell.
I had not lifted my veil when I first spoke to the woman, which was at the moment of our going in. The boy staggered up instantly and stared at me with a remarkable expression of surprise and terror. His action was so quick, and my being the cause of it was so evident, that I stood still instead of advancing nearer.
"I won't go no more to the burying ground," muttered the boy. "I ain't a-going there, so I tell you."
I lifted my veil and spoke to the woman. She said to me in a low voice,
"Don't mind him, ma'am. He'll soon come back to his head,"
and said to him, "Joe,
Joe, what's the matter?" "I know what she's come for," cried the boy.
"Who?"
"The lady there. She's come to get me to go along with her to the burying ground. I won't go to the burying ground. I don't like the name on it. She might go a-burying me."
His shivering came on again, and as he leaned against the wall, he shook the hovel.
"He's been talking off and on about such like all day, ma'am," said Jenny softly. "Why, how you stare! This is my lady, Joe."
"Is it?"
returned the boy doubtfully, and surveying me with his arm held out above his burning eyes.
"She looks to me the t'other one. It ain't the bonnet, nor yet it ain't the gown, but she looks to me the t'other one."
My little Charlie, with her premature experience of illness and trouble, had pulled off her bonnet and shawl and now went quietly up to him with a chair, and sat him down in it like an old sick nurse, except that no such attendant could have shown him Charlie's youthful face, which seemed to engage his confidence.
"I say," said the boy, "you tell me, ain't the lady the t'other lady?"
Charlie shook her head as she methodically drew his rags about him and made him as warm as she could.
"Oh,"
the boy muttered,
"then I suppose she ain't."
"I came to see if I could do you any good," said I. "What is the matter with you?"
"I'm a being froze," returned the boy hoarsely, with his haggard gaze wandering about me. "And then burnt up, and then froze, and then burnt up, ever so many times in an hour. And my head's all sleepy, and all a-going mad-like, and I'm so dry. And my bones isn't half so much bones as pain."
"When did he come here?" I asked the woman. "This morning, ma'am. I found him at the corner of the town. I had known him up in London yonder, hadn't I, Joe?"
"Tom All Alone's," the boy replied.
Whenever he fixed his attention or his eyes, it was only for a very little while. He soon began to droop his head again and roll it heavily, and speak as if he were half awake.
"When did he come from London?" I asked. "I come from London yesterday," said the boy himself, now flushed and hot. "I'm a-going somewheres."
"Where is he going?" I asked.
"Somewheres," repeated the boy in a louder tone. "I've been moved on, and moved on more nor ever I was afore, since the t'other one give me the sovereign. Mrs. Snagsby, she's always a-watching and a-driving of me. What have I done to her? And they're all a-watching and a-driving of me. Every one of 'em's doing it, from the time when I don't get up to the time when I don't go to bed. And I'm a-going somewheres. That's where I'm a-going. She told me, down in Tom All Alone's, as she came from Stolben's. And so I took the Stolben's road. It's as good as another."
He always concluded by addressing Charlie. "What is to be done with him?" said I, taking the woman aside. "He could not travel in this state, even if he had a purpose and knew where he was going."
"I know no more, ma'am, than the dead,"
she replied, glancing compassionately at him. "Perhaps the dead know better, if they could only tell us. I've kept him here all day for pity's sake, and I've given him broth and physic, and Liz has gone to try if anyone will take him in. Here's my pretty in the bed, her child, but I call it mine. But I can't keep him long, for if my husband was to come home and find him here, he'd be rough in putting him out, and might do him a hurt. Hark, here comes Liz back."
The other woman came hurriedly in as she spoke, and the boy got up with a half-obscured sense that he was expected to be going.
When the little child awoke, and when and how Charlie got at it, took it out of bed, and began to walk about hushing it, I don't know. There she was, doing all this in a quiet, motherly manner, as if she were living in Mrs. Blinder's attic, with Tom and Emma again. The friend had been here and there, and had been played about from hand to hand, and had come back as she went. At first it was too early for the boy to be received into the proper refuge, and at last it was too late. One official sent her to another, and the other sent her back again to the first, and so backward and forward, until it appeared to me as if both must have been appointed for their skill in evading their duties instead of performing them. And now, after all, she said, breathing quickly, for she had been running and was frightened too,
"Jenny,
Your master's on the road home, and mine's not far behind, and the Lord help the boy, for we can do no more for him." They put a few halfpence together and hurried them into his hand, and so, in an oblivious, half-thankful, half-insensible way, he shuffled out of the house. "Give me the child, my dear," said its mother to Charlie, "and thank you kindly, too. Jenny, woman dear, good night. Young lady, if my master don't fall out with me, I'll look down by the kiln by and by, where the boy will be most like, and again in the morning." She hurried off, and presently we passed her hushing and singing to her child at her own door, and looking anxiously along the road for her drunken husband. I was afraid of staying then to speak to either woman, lest I should bring her into trouble, but I said to Charlie that we must not leave the boy to die. Charlie, who knew what to do much better than I did, and whose quickness equalled her presence of mind, glided on before me, and presently we came up with Joe, just short of the brick kiln. I think he must have begun his journey with some small bundle under his arm, and must have had it stolen or lost it, for he still carried his wretched fragment of fur cap like a bundle, though he went bareheaded through the rain, which now fell fast. He stopped when we called to him, and again showed a dread of me when I came up, standing with his lustrous eyes fixed upon me, and even arrested in his shivering fit. I asked him to come with us, and we would take care that he had some shelter for the night.
"I don't want no shelter," he said. "I can lie amongst the warm bricks."
"But don't you know that people die there?" replied Charlie.
"They dies everywheres," said the boy. "They dies in their lodgings. She knows where, I showed her. And they dies down in Tom All Alone's in heaps. They dies more than they lives, according to what I see."
Then he hoarsely whispered Charlie,
"If she ain't the t'other one, she ain't the foreigner. Is there three of 'em, then?"
Charlie looked at me a little frightened. I felt half frightened at myself when the boy glared on me so. But he turned and followed when I beckoned to him, and finding that he acknowledged that influence in me, I led the way straight home. It was not far, only at the summit of the hill. We passed but one man. I doubted if we should have got home without assistance. The boy's steps were so uncertain and tremulous. He made no complaint, however, and was strangely unconcerned about himself, if I may say so strange a thing. Leaving him in the hall for a moment, shrunk into the corner of the window-seat, and staring with an indifference that scarcely could be called wonder at the comfort and brightness about him, I went into the drawing-room to speak to my guardian. There I found Mr. Skimpole, who had come down by the coach, as he frequently did without notice, and never bringing any clothes with him, but always borrowing everything he wanted. They came out with me directly to look at the boy. The servants had gathered in the hall, too, and he shivered in the window-seat with Charlie standing by him, like some wounded animal that had been found in a ditch.
"This is a sorrowful case," said my guardian, after asking him a question or two, and touching him, and examining his eyes. "What do you say, Harold?"
"You had better turn him out," said Mr. Skimpole.
"What do you mean?" inquired my guardian, almost sternly.
"My dear Jarndyce," said Mr. Skimpole, "you know what I am. I'm a child. Be cross to me if I deserve it, but I have a constitutional objection to this sort of thing. I always had when I was a medical man. He's not safe, you know. There's a very bad sort of fever about him."
Mr. Skimpole had retreated from the hall to the drawing-room again, and said this in his airy way, seated on the music-stool as we stood by.
"You'll say it's childish," observed Mr. Skimpole, looking gaily at us. "Well, I dare say it may be, but I am a child, and I never pretend to be anything else. If you put him out in the road, you only put him where he was before. He'll be no worse off than he was, you know. Even make him better off, if you like. Give him sixpence, or 5 shillings, or £5.10. You are arithmeticians, and I'm not, and get rid of him."
"And what is he to do then?" asked my guardian.
"Upon my life," said Mr. Skimpole, shrugging his shoulders with his engaging smile, "I have not the least idea what he is to do then, but I have no doubt he'll do it."
"Now, is it not a horrible reflection?" said my guardian, to whom I had hastily explained the unavailing efforts of the two women. "Is it not a horrible reflection," walking up and down and rumpling his hair, "that if this wretched creature were a convicted prisoner, his hospital would be wide open to him, and he would be as well taken care of as any sick boy in the kingdom?"
"My dear Jarndyce," returned Mr. Skimpole, "you'll pardon the simplicity of the question, coming as it does from a creature who is perfectly simple in worldly matters, but why isn't he a prisoner, then?"
My guardian stopped and looked at him with a whimsical mixture of amusement and indignation in his face.
"'Our young friend is not to be suspected of any delicacy, I should imagine,' said Mr. Skimpole, unabashed and candid. "'It seems to me that it would be wiser, as well as in a certain kind of way more respectable, if he showed some misdirected energy that got him into prison. There would be more of an adventurous spirit in it, and consequently more of a certain sort of poetry.' "'I believe,' returned my guardian, resuming his uneasy walk, "'that there is not such another child on earth as yourself.' "'Do you really?' said Mr. Skimpole. "'I dare say. "'But I confess I don't see why our young friend, in his degree, "'should not seek to invest himself with such poetry as is open to him. "'He is no doubt born with an appetite. "'Probably, when he is in a safer state of health, he has an excellent appetite. "'Very well. "'But our young friend's natural dinner hour, most likely about noon, "'our young friend says, in effect, to society, "'I am hungry. "'Will you have the goodness to produce your spoon and feed me?' Society, which has taken upon itself the general arrangement of the whole system of spoons, and professes to have a spoon for our young friend, does not produce that spoon, and our young friend therefore says, "You really must excuse me if I see